ॐ असतो मा सन्नगमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मामृतङ्गमय आविरामीर्मयेधि रुद्रायत् ते दक्षिणमुखं ते नमां पाहित्यम्. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness unto light. Lead us from death to immortality. Reach us through and through ourselves, and evermore protect us from ignorance by thy sweet, compassionate face. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Ma Vindvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us, lovingly as Mother and Father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a Mother and Father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Before I begin the subject, some of you may remember that I talked a couple of weeks ago about a physicist who had put a drop of unmissable ink in a vat of oil, and how he had cranked it to turn it round and round, and the oil. Now, the ink drop disappeared being circulated into this turning oil. And then when he reversed it and turned it back, all the ink drop came back and coalesced into the same place from where it started. I remember that? Some of you remember that?
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of the name of the man. It's David Bohm. Mm-hmm. David Bohm did this experiment. And he's very famous. He died recently, not very long ago. It's a most interesting experiment. And I used it as an analogy for how in the Upanishads says the universe is all spun out from a single source and comes back again without being mixed with any of the things that it's supposed to have produced. It's interesting for you. Well, welcome to this morning's topic, which is the 15th in the series of Sages of the Upanishads. And the Upanishad that we have to deal with this morning is called the Prashna Upanishad. This is the Upanishad which belongs to the sage Pippalada. Pippalada is all we know about, much we know about him, except what he teaches in the Prashna Upanishad. Evidently a very eminent sage. And we're going to hear about him and six of his disciples. The Prashna Upanishad consists of six. The word Prashna means question. Sanskrit word meaning question. And these six individuals, these disciples, come to the sage, and each of them asks a question, and he's supposed to answer it. They hope he will answer it. And so we're going to study this morning Pippalada, and the six disciples. They come to him with fuel in hand, as we've discussed before. Why do the pupils come with fuel in hand, with wood? Because fire is the fire is of the essence in that culture. All of the sacrificial fires are burned in the earlier part of the Veda, and they go on for a long time. Some people still make them today. Some people still do Vedic sacrifice even today in India. Not very many, but some do. And so, and the teacher has, of course, to make fire for cooking, and he has to make fire for keeping warm. So one of the most valuable things at that time would be useful wood fuel, tinder and so on, being brought by the pupils. And so it makes a point of saying that here they arrive with fuel in hand. Well, these people come, I'm going to summarize it. They come and they are indeed devoted to Brahman, intent on Brahman, seeking the highest Brahman. All of these things are said about the six disciples, that they are highly devoted to Brahman and intent on him and trying to know the highest Brahman. So they approach the revered Pipalada with sacrificial fuel in their hands, thinking he would explain everything to them. To them, now don't be depressed, to them that seer said, "Live with me another year with austerity, chastity, and shraddha, and then ask your questions according to your desire, and if we know, we will answer them." This is such a diplomatic answer. I really admire this sage. He says, "If we know, we will answer them." That's humility unexpected in a Upanishadic sage, I must say. Most of them don't show that kind of deference to the pupil. He says, "Then ask, if I know, I will tell you." So, postponed for a year. Now you see, even in monastic life today in India, this has very little meaning. There undoubtedly are young men who join who are impatient and would like to have everything happen very quickly. In my own particular case, I had to wait many years to get my vows because of various vicissitudes. But there are young men who come in India, Indian men, they grieve about having to wait for their brahmacharya vows, their novitiates. They grieve about having to wait so long, 4 years after that, for their sannyasa vows. So you see, in India it's a minimum of 4 years to brahmacharya and another 4 years to sannyasa. At least, if there are no hitches, if something doesn't happen in between. And so, this is not really a great thing to ask them to wait one more year before he answers their questions. The hitch, or the trick of it is, what he asks them to do, he says, "You are to practice austerity and chastity and shraddha." Of course, the translator has translated that as faith, but we've been over this many times. Shraddha, much more than the English word faith implies. Shraddha covers a vast number of ideas. Self-esteem, confidence, a positive attitude toward life, and the renunciation of negativities, optimism. You could find a lot of semi-synonyms no real equivalent of the word Shraddha, which in India, in Sanskrit, means oomph, in the kind of thrust that you have to have for feeling that nothing is impossible for you. You have the power within you. You have the potentiality. You can do it if you make up your mind to it. All those things are involved in Shraddha. All right, so he says these are the things you have to practice, and they are, of course, standard for all inquirers of truth in those days. These people were all aspiring sages. Austerity, tapas. What does it mean? It means enduring heat and cold without complaining. It means fasting if no food is available at the time. And all of these things without complaining or without trying to redress their grievance. The austerity of wakefulness, depriving oneself of the luxury of sleep if there's a need or if one wishes to test oneself and so on. To keep vigil. The austerity of repeating a mantra for hours together or days together or various kinds, prayaschitta, other kinds of penances that are done in accordance with the phase of the moon and all those things. They are to do these things as tapas. And chastity, of course, taken for granted. And then he said that he would try to answer them. Well, let's meet the first disciple. His name is excuse me. His name is Kabanti. Kabanti addresses the sage Pippalada with the epithet Bhagavan. And it's translated in English here as Sir. It's more than Sir. He comes to him with reverence. Bhagavan means God, and Bhagavan is God in the nominative, and in the evocative it's Bhagavan. So, Sir, revered Sir. That's the way we do it now. We translate it in our movement as revered sir, or revered Maharaj, or whoever, whatever it is. So he says, Bhagavan, revered sir, let me read you what he says, asks. He came back after a year. They all came back after a year. And so he comes back and he says, asks, let me find it. I want to get to the right place here. Oh, here it is. Sir, venerable sir, revered sir, whence, verily, are all these creatures born? Now I'm calling him an early Darwinian. Kabanti has the Darwinian outlook on life, and he wants to know, where did all these creatures, these phyla, come from? And Pippalada gives him an answer. He says that they are the offspring of Prajapati. Now, Prajapati means progenitor. It's a cognate word, Prajapati. Progenitor, the creator, the one who started everything. He gives him a theistic answer, in a way, because he points out to him a being, a creator who is active, not just a Nirguna Brahman, but a Saguna Brahman. Prajapati was desirous of offspring. Talk about making God in your own image. Like us, we who desire to have children and raise families, so he attributes that to the Lord of creation. He says Prajapati was desirous of offspring. And he performed austerity. And having performed austerity, he produced the first pair, Adam. It doesn't say Adam and Eve, you know. He produced the first pair. And what do you think this first pair is now? You see here, this is where the Upanishad is so different from all the other scriptures of the world. The first pair are matter and energy. Rayi means matter, and prana. You can make your own definition of prana. Energy, force. The best word for it is energy, but we can use it in. We all know what prana means, so maybe we better use that word because you know it covers a wider scope than our English word energy usually does. So maybe we'll just keep it. So he says, the master of creation desired offspring and did tapas. I left that out, I forgot. He did tapas in order to produce the first pair. The creator had to do tapas. And here tapas can mean heat, generate heat. He had to concentrate, he had to meditate, maybe make japa, we don't know what all is implied in the tapas of the creator. But the creator himself had to do tapas, had to perform austerity. Well, you know, when you're getting ready for children, you have to do all kinds of preparations. So he had some kind of preparation to make before he could produce this pair. And the pair was matter and energy. And the interesting thing is that in this story, matter is a feminine word and prana is a masculine word. Mm-hmm. And later they became, of course, reversed. The whole history of the later development of science and philosophy makes the prana feminine. She, Shakti. The cosmic force is looked on throughout almost the rest of the Indian history as feminine, but not here. In the beginning, prana was masculine. Is masculine word. I mean, the name, the word itself is masculine. Rayi is feminine. So later times changed it all. Now from these two, all is produced. Everything will come from these two entities. And I think Aristotle it was who had the first pair, Aristotle, the pagan philosopher, and before Adam and Eve, he had matter and form as his pair. Now that's not too difficult to relate to this because forms are made by energy. It's energy which changes forms from one to another, which is responsible for the succession of forms throughout time. Energy is responsible for that. So Aristotle, too, wasn't so very far off as far as this comparing with this is concerned. He had matter and form. Form, I think, just form in the singular. Well, our sage Pippalada says that there are two kinds of matter, gross and subtle. And that's very important, and I've stressed it in so many of my talks to you, because it's so difficult for science or common education in the West to accept the idea of a subtle matter which does not always follow the expectations we have of gross matter as far as the laws are concerned and so on. We know how to handle gross matter in and subject it to experimentation and so on and so forth. When it comes to the subtle matter, we haven't yet worked out the ways to subject psychic material and events to proper analysis and experimentation. So I think it's important for us to take note of the fact that in the very earliest philosophies we have, it's already determined, already been noticed that there are two degrees or two types of matter, gross and subtle. And another further important point, both of them have form. Form is to be found in the subtle matter as well as in the gross. So when you talk about worshiping God with form, worshiping God formless, you've got three things to deal with. Sri Ramakrishna goes to the Kali temple and worships the Divine Mother in a black stone image. There's worship of God in the gross matter. He has a vision, he has many visions of her and many other deities, which are in the subtle matter, realm of subtle matter. But there are forms, they are forms, all kinds of forms. He goes and finds Vivekananda seated among the seven sages in a realm where there are forms. Beyond that is the formless. And that's beyond matter and energy. So here's the kind of cosmology that we already have from the very first questioner gets this. Well, let's meet the second one. His name is Bhargava. There are families in Atlanta who have this name, Bhargavas. I know a family with that name. See how it happens? You know them. They're prominent Atlantans, been here for years. How do they get to have this name? These are the ancestors. These are the antecedents. These are the name givers to whole sequence. Just imagine, here we are, 4,000 years from the time of this sage, and still the lineage of his name goes on. Still there are people born into the gotra, into the group which have the name Bhargava. No, you're proud of your southern ancestry. show me a comparable. So anyway, his name is Bhargava. I just wanted to comment on that because it's the only one that I know of, people whom I know have that name. Now Bhargava is a cosmologist. I've given all of these people a nickname, a moniker. First one was, what? He was a Darwinian. This one is a cosmologist. He asks Pippalada, how many different powers support this world? How many illuminate? And which is the greatest? And Pippalada, strangely enough, does not reply. Prana replies. He turns to Prana and asks him to answer the question. Prana is masculine, so I say him. Well, and this is what Prana says. I'm abbreviating everything so that we can get through the whole Upanishad this morning. Venerable Sir, how many powers support the created world? How many illuminate and what is great? To him, Prana said, do not cherish this delusion of multiplicity. I alone, dividing myself fivefold, sustain and support this body. Wow. Now what has happened? The pupil asked about the universe, and Prana said, body. What do you make of that?
Whose body is talking?
Prana.
No, but isn't prana just energy? The energy, that's some energy.
Prana is personalized here, personified. This is a trick that the Upanishads do all the time. You know that. They don't just stick to your idea of what's a force and what's an energy. Prana is personified and speaks and gives an answer. I'm more interested not in what you're asking, I'm interested in asking another question. Why does he say the body?
Well, that relates to my question, though, because is he talking about his own body?
No, the body of man, any body. Yes, I'm sorry, yes, no. But no, he doesn't have a physical body, this prana, no. He's speaking in a...
In the previous talk, you explained that the gods are part of this body, and so the energies are most likely, what we know, are part of the body too.
Yes, yes. That's getting near to it.
The body's the microcosm.
Right. The body is the microcosm, the universe is the macrocosm. This is the important thing about the Upanishads all the way along. You're asking about the external nature? Try to understand that external nature is a projection of what you have inside. What we have in here is what makes what's out there. Smile and the world smiles with you. Cry and you cry alone. You cry and the world will cry too. But especially on Tuesdays. But anyway. But anyway, this is the point that goes right down through the whole of all of this knowledge. See, he wants the Pipalada asks Prana or speaks as Prana because he wants the disciple to understand that he must draw his mind in from the investigation of all of this and get back to what's going on here in the psychophysical organism. That's where it all comes from. That's where it starts. See, he said, don't fall into this delusion. What is the delusion? The delusion that there is an external universe that somehow doesn't have its origin and explanation in your consciousness. Okay, I alone, dividing myself fivefold, sustain and support this body. Well, somebody who doesn't want to accept this Advaitic interpretation will come along and say, body, body, he meant the universal body, the universe. They believed him not. Just like you. Just like us. I should say. Just like us. They believed him not. And so on. Then there's a lot of things. Oh yes, this is worth reading to you. Let me get my notes back here. Well, I'll just tell it to you. He says, he went up upward from the body, and when he went up, all the other forces of the body went too. And this is so interesting. When he settled down, a prana made a motion, upward motion in his body, and he came down again. And when he settled down, all the others too settled down. This, as all the bees go up when the king bee goes up, and as they settle down when the king bee settles down, even so speech, mind, sight, and hearing, they being satisfied, praise prana. He's trying to show how all the pranas are united in one. They all have one director, one controller, one central power, and they've all, when that one goes up, they all go with him. As you know, you feel in the body when a current is rising, one kind of current, blood circulation and so on, all of the currents that you feel in the body, they tend to go in unison in one direction or another. One draws the others up. But the interesting thing here is they call him masculine, the king bee. How would you expect them to know it was a queen? This is the kind of detail that you cannot expect to get scientifically in the Upanishads. King bee is no king at all, it's a queen. That's all right. The idea is made, the point is made. And so his question is answered. I'm going to summarize it like this. As spokes in the center of a wheel, everything is established in prana. From this one central prana, everything comes. The Rig verses, the Yajurs, the parts of the Vedas, the different Vedas, the Samans, the chants, and sacrifice, valor, and wisdom, all are derived from prana. As the Lord of creatures that moves in the womb, it is then thyself that art born again. This is the seed of the doctrine of reincarnation. It's you yourself who are born in the seed that is in the womb. O life, creatures, bring offerings to thee who dwellest with the vital breath. And so on. There's some things that are not significant here. You, O prana, are the chief bearer of offerings to the gods. You are the first offering to the fathers. You are the true practice of the seers. Celebration of the glory of prana. And here, he's addressing prana. Pipalada has gone back, left his detached position and gone to address prana, and is glorifying him, telling him all these wonderful things. Well, now we go to the third one, whose name is Kausalya. Kausalya is a scientist. We would call him today a pure scientist. And his question is a compound question. Apparently, after a year of all that practice, they were allowed to ask compound questions in some cases, anyway. So he comes to him and asks a compound question. What do you think it is? Wouldn't you know? That's why I call him a scientist. Where does the prana come from? Where does this prana come from? Oh boy. How does it come into the body? Now they're focusing on the body. The original inquiry was apparently extraterritorial, it was terrestrial, cosmic. And now the relationship between disciples and the teacher has become one in which they recognize that the body first, the microcosm must be understood before there can be explanation of the macrocosm in truth. So he says, where does this all prana come from? How does it get into the body? How does it depart when the body drops dead? How does it support the environment? See, they got that idea already, that the body, something in the prana in the body supports the environment. Prana at least supports the environment. Oh, I see. No, he has divided it here. How does it support the environment, and how does it support the self? These are his last two parts of his questions. And what do you think Pupilata says? He says what all Americans say when they're a little perplexed. Good questions. He says, you've asked some good questions. So this is not anything new in our culture. It goes way, way back. Did you hear Swami Yogatmananda when he said that at the retreat? Yes, last year the Swami who came, year before last, the Swami came to the retreat and said, I have learned your American trick. And when somebody asks something difficult, you first say, that's a good question. And that gives you time to think up an answer. So, what? Yeah, didn't. So, now they don't have that. He thought they didn't have that in India, but I have to show him. He had it a long time ago. He calls them ati prashnas. You know that ati prashnas, questions beyond, super questions. That you could say, super questions, ati prashna. So you have asked. Super questions. Now let's see what he says in answer. Oh, he says to Kausalya, you are very devoted to Brahman. I butter him up, you know. You are very devoted to Brahman. And so I will answer your questions. Yeah. I'll answer your question because you are very devoted to Brahman. Then he does. He answers the question. He says, from the Atman, as its shadow, comes all this manifestation. Again, highest philosophy. Because the shadow of something hasn't got, has it, the same degree of reality as the thing which is casting the shadow. So that means that the whole manifested universe, which comes out of the self as projection, has a different degree of reality. It has existence. Nobody denies, nobody says she's a lady without a shadow. They say, she's got a shadow. They've got a shadow, and I admit the shadow, and I see the shadow. But the shadow has not got the degree of reality that I attribute to the object which is reflected there. So he's giving him the highest philosophy, and if you want to pass it over, you can pass it over, as the dualists do. They don't make anything out of that. They will say simply that that's poetry. He does manifest himself by transformation. A part of him gets transformed into this universe. This is called the theory of transformational evolution, parinama. And actually, matter actually gets transformed through time into different forms, and evolution takes place. The whole universe evolves just as science says it does. And that is, of course, the dualist's way, or qualified non-dualist's way, of explaining this verse. But then he goes on and he says, mind itself creates the body and the places of prana in the body. And you can see how from these scant pronouncements the doctrine of karma and reincarnation was drawn out. He says when the body dies, the prana departs, taking with it its subdivisions, and proceeds to find another abode. And after finding that other abode, eventually it again returns to earth and enters another. All of that is not here. That is implied here. A little bit of it is here. And then the rest of it is brought into realization by succeeding generations. All the laws of karma and reincarnation are brought to the fore through later Upanishads and the doctrines of the texts of Vedanta. But all you get here are scant phrases like this: mind itself creates a body and the places of prana in that body. And I'm going to read you verse 12 here. The birth, the entrance, the abode, the fivefold overlordship, and the relation to self of life. Knowing these, one obtains immortality. Knowing these, one attains immortality. So in order to get beyond death and attain to the immortal, you have to know how prana brings about the birth, the entrance into the body, the abode, where it's going, how the prana is distributed fivefold over the body, and its relation to the self. And of course he's already told you what its relation is. It's related to self as a shadow is to an object. Well, it's a very, very interesting question that he asked, and a very long explanation. In fact, it goes on for other verses which I didn't read before, all about the sun and for instance, the sun verily rises as the external prana, for it is that which helps the prana in the eye. You can't see without the sun, you see. The divinity which is in the earth supports a person's outgoing breath. And so he breaks it all down, which we don't have time to read, go over today.
Does he talk about the moon too? Does he go on to talk about the moon?
The moon?
The shadow?
Yes, the moon is mentioned here. We're going to come to that in a minute. That's getting ahead a little bit. The moon will be mentioned. Now, what do you think Gargya is? Gargya is the fourth questioner, fourth disciple. And Gargya is, that name is interesting. It means a derivative of Gargi. You remember Gargi? Gargi was the woman mystic, the woman philosopher, who challenged Yajnavalkya. We've met Gargi before. So this may be the son or grandson of Gargi, very possibly. That would be expectable. And what is his question? He's the psychologist. What are the forces which are working in sleep in this person? What are the forces? What are the forces? What are the pranas and the forces of prana which sleep, and what are the ones that do not sleep? What keeps awake? Who sees the dreams?
psychologist, see. Who sees the dreams? And who is made happy by the satisfaction of sleep? Who holds all of it together? These are smart pupils, aren't they? Yeah. And Pippalata uses the analogy of he answers the last question first. The last question was, who holds it? What holds it all together? Who holds it all together? And he answers that question first by with the word mind. He says, it is the mind that holds all this together. And then the other question about sleep, other questions about sleep, he says, it gives the analogy of the sun, sunset. Just as when it's time for the sun to rise, everything becomes light and all full awareness is there. There's everything's exposed. So the waking up comes to the waking state. That's like the sunrise. And when he goes to sleep at night, that's like the sunset. When the sun goes down and you can't see anything and it all becomes dark. And this analogy goes all through the Upanishads. Reincarnation implies the death of the day and the rebirth of the day. The rhythm of the year and so on. All of that is tied up with the doctrine of karma and reincarnation. Then, what else does he say? Oh, I'm going to read one to you. Yes. Dr. Radhakrishnan, who translated this book, gives us this interesting note here. He says, life is conceived as a sacrifice, and the three life breaths, which are mentioned in the three, I guess I should read the verse first. The fires of life alone remain awake in this city, the city of the body. The householder, and he talks about the kinds of fires that are used mentioned in the Vedic sacrifices. The householder's fire is the out-breath. The southern or sacrificial fire is the diffused breath. The in-breath is the oblation fire from being taken, since it is taken from the householder's fire. These are details of the Vedic sacrifice. Now I have to explain it through the note. Life is conceived as a sacrifice, and these three life breaths are symbolically identified with the fires used in the Vedic sacrifice. Garhapatya, householder's fire, and it is the sacred home fire kept burning at home. And then there's the southern sacrificial fire. I think you can just get a general idea here that the karmakanda and the jnanakanda, the early part of the Veda, which is the sacrificial and work and performance of work, they call work karmas, and the jnanakanda, or the thought part, the Upanishads, the meditations and philosophies, are intricately woven together. There's not a gulf between them, and the earliest of the Upanishads show how they are knit together, because they present passages from the old part of the Veda in the new part, and they are evolutionarily derived one from the other. They're new from the old, and so here's a very good example of how the sage is using the familiar terminology of these people who live in a sacrificial fire culture to bring home to them the need to see that this, there's a fire burning in our breast, that all of the forces that are moving our blood and are circulating the electricity through our nerves and so on, and running the brain cells, all of this is an electric fire. This is all due to energy. And those energies which are here are the ones by which we explain who's doing what. And so it's just an echo from the Vedic times. He gives a long answer, and it goes on and on and on, and I'm not going to read that because we are running out of time. I want to get the other two in if we can. The fifth one is Satyakama. This is not the Satyakama that we met before. This is another Satyakama, son of Shibi. He asked him, "Venerable Sir, what world does he who among men meditates on the syllable Om until the end of his life win by that? What do you get by meditating on Om all your life?" That's the way I put it. This is a mystic. And he says that, asks that. What do you get by meditating on Om all your life? Apparently that's what he's doing, you know. Pipalada replies, Om is the higher Brahman and the lower Brahman. See, he says, the ultimate reality is of two kinds, just as matter is of two kinds. The ultimate reality, too, is of two kinds. A higher one, which is formless, nameless, indescribable, nirguna Brahman, and a lower one, which is saguna Brahman. And if you repeat just, the first, Om is three different letters, you know, A, U, Ma. And if you only repeat A, what you get is a quick return to earth. You die, you're going to be reborn very quickly, if all you can say is A. Don't ask me to explain this. If you can say A-U, you go to the moon world. That's what you are asking about. You go to the world of the moon, the stratosphere. Somewhere out there, one of those heavens that they talk about. If you go, just say A-U. But if you say Om, and you do it rightly, and you do it earnestly, you go to Brahmaloka, the world of Brahman. And then after that, other Upanishads spin out a whole explanation of Brahmaloka. Who goes there, how long they stay, who doesn't go there, and what happens when the end of the cycle comes. There's another cosmology is spun out regarding Brahmaloka. So today we only learn that if you can say Om properly all your life, you will go to Brahmaloka when you die. That's where Brahman is, you know. That's a good place to go. Okay. Now we come to Sukta. The last one is Sukesha. Where is he? Then Sukesha. The Sukesha is the last one, and I have to describe him just as a truth seeker. He is the son of Bharadwaja, one of the sages who asked a question before, one of the students, so he probably brought his smart young son, and both of them came as students. Well, he tells, he asks the question about, he tells a story. He tells a story about a prince. He says, this is what happened to me, sir. My question starts with a story. A prince of the Kosala kingdom, approached me one day and asked this question. Bharadwaja, son of Bharadwaja, do you know the person with 16 parts? Do you know the person who has 16 parts? I replied to that prince, I know him not. If I had known him, why should I not tell you about it? Verily, to his roots he withers who speaks an untruth. Therefore it is not proper for me to speak untruth. I do not know. In silence, the prince mounted his chariot and departed. Now, I ask you about it. Who is the person of 16 parts? I was stuck. I told the truth. I am a truth seeker, and I am a truthful person. Oh, I want the truth from you. You be as truthful as I was. There's an additional note. He who speaks an untruth withers to his roots. I guess that's the commentator. All right. So now I'll read to you. As these let's see, 6 and 7. Yeah, he gives the illustration of the whole of creation. Oh, I see. Let's see, 6 and 7. Even here within the body, O my dear, is that person in whom these 16 parts arise. He thought within himself, when I shall be departing, in whose departure shall it be? And in whose settling down shall I be settling down? And he created life, prana. From prana came shraddha, the five elements, the sense organs, mind, food. From food came vital vigor, austerity, hymns, works, worlds, and the world's name, and the names of the world. All creation came up from this 16-parted person. As these flowing rivers tending toward the ocean, on reaching the ocean, disappear, and their name and shape is broken up. Of course, this is a very common idea later on in the literature, and are called simply ocean. Even so, of this sphere, these 16 parts tending towards the person, that supreme person, on reaching that supreme person, disappear. Their name and shape are broken up. They are called simply the person. That one, Purusha. Purusha. That one is without parts, immortal. And this is where the word Purusha comes in, and this is where the Sankhya philosophy picks it up and uses that word for its central figure, central entity, Purusha and Prakriti. So this one, he's without parts. All the 16 parts disappear. And Radhakrishnan, scholar that he is, quotes a verse from Christina Rossetti. Lord, we are rivers running to thy sea. Our waves and ripples all derived from thee. A nothing we should have, a nothing be, except for thee. And Eckhart, he quotes too, when I go back into the ground, into the depths, into the wellspring of the Godhead, no one will ask me whence I came or whither I went. And Pippalada says, in whom the parts are well established as spokes in the center of a wheel, know him as the person to be known, so that death may not afflict you. And to them, The six, Dipalada said, thus far do I know, that's as far as I know of the Supreme Brahman, there is nothing higher than that. And they praised him and said, thou indeed art our father who takes us across the other shore of ignorance. The glory of the Upanishads. I never can prepare or read or prepare a talk on this, on these sages without being overcome by how profound, how ancient, how much deeper than most of the roots of religion go, how inspiring they are to us to think that these thousands of years later we can still access this wisdom and profit by it and even realize its goal, its summum bonum. Questions or comments are in order. Yes, Joey?
I think it was the first sage who mentioned prana dividing itself into five parts, and as we understand, to support both the body and support the universe. Is the number five significant, or is that just, are there five that they specify?
Well, let's look at it. There are five pranas. There are five subtle elements from which the prakriti, which prakriti uses to produce the five gross elements, of course, because there are five subtle elements, there are five gross elements. I don't know whether there are any other fives, but five, there are five fingers and five toes. Now, I suppose that we go really go back, we go back to something like that, that people began to take their fingers, their digits, you know, and to enumerate things on their fingers. I don't know. I can't tell you, I give you an esoteric, learned, informed answer on the origin of the five. But this looks a little arbitrary. But since the earliest sages have declared that this was revealed to them by, in meditation, in I don't see why we need to doubt it, you know. I don't think it is purely arbitrary. No, of course I don't. I think that they looked into themselves and found certain principal trends of energy, and that they looked into nature and felt that it was consisted of five basic phenomena. Anybody else?
Swami, along those lines, maybe Bernard can correct me if I'm wrong. Physicists recognize four forces operating in the universe, basic forces. They call them, one of them is called strong force, weak force, electromagnetic radiation force, and then gravity.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the string theory recognizes a fifth force or not.
It's not his field. There are fields all over, but not in them.
Well, physics is not my field also, but this is something that I've been interested in.
Yeah.
And they do recognize four fundamental forces operating in the universe.
Yeah.
Maybe this fifth force is the...
Akash.
The Akasha, Atman, or something, I don't know. It's I got to go back and look at... Do you remember from that program?
Yeah.
I don't know whether they recognize the fifth force or not. I may be totally wrong here, but they do recognize four forces.
Yes, but they're really, those four forces are really not comparable at all to the five elements. The only person I know that has really tried to do this, spent his life at it, is John Dobson. And then I don't know how much he's succeeded either. I hope he has, to some extent. Any other questions? There's been a library checkup, you know, overdue books and things like that. So if on the way out we give you a little chit, with the name of a book on it. Please don't feel offended. And just it, sometimes the librarian makes mistakes, and there are inaccuracies in the records, and so it may not be your fault. It may be the fault of the librarian. So just have a look at home and see if that book is with you. And if not, let me know that you were improperly insulted.
There are others.
Huh?
There are others.
There are, yes, you aren't the only one, Charlton. Let us, before we do our prayer, let us rejoice in having back with us a couple of long, or three long missing people, Linda Gordon and Alston and Charlton. So, make them welcome after you leave. We have a new system now, too. Nobody leaves until I go first. That way I catch everybody on the way out.
Sorry, how did I not update? I'm keeping, as y'all know, we're updating our mailing list, and we've instituted a membership list. For those of you who have not filled out a membership form, please do so. The annual meetings coming up in December. You can't vote at the annual meeting unless you're a member. All you have to do is fill out a little form. You don't have to even give us any money or anything, although we like that too. But mainly, we need your
got a good secretary.
Information. And if your information changes, please either tell Swami or me.
Do you have any more than that?
Okay.
We've got stacks.
Okay, I'll take
it. Oh, and next Sunday is open forum, and the topic is, can one practice Bhakti and Jnana together? So be thinking about that and tell us your experience, your experiences, and it's your turn. I'm not going to be saying very much, so be prepared for the open forum. Right. Let's say our prayer. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail
throughout my being. Om Shanti. Shanti, Shanti. Om, peace be unto us and all beings everywhere.